Members, we're going to get started with the House Commerce Committee meeting, and we're going to start with having Mr. Headley come down, and we look forward to your presentation, sir.
Thank you, Mr.
If you would, when you start, please identify yourself for the record and feel free to proceed.
We're awaiting some PowerPoint slides to be printed off, so we apologize for the delay on this, but we certainly can proceed.
Yeah, Mr. Chad, that'd be fine to start. We'll get the slides up as soon as we can.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and good afternoon, members of the Commerce Committee. My name is Terry Headley. I'm from Omaha, Nebraska, and I'm the immediate past president of NAFA, the National Association of Insurance and Financial Advisors. Just by way of history, NAFA is the oldest and largest association for agents and financial advisors. Been in existence since 1890. We have 200,000 members and their associates across the country, with a state association in every state, and some 608 local associations across the country. Obviously, we are very involved in activities of legislation and regulation, and today it's my distinct honor and privilege to address you on the impact of the Dodd-Frank legislation that was signed into law July 21st of 2010, and also known as the Wall Street Reform and Consumer Protection Act. And of course, there's a lot of rationale and sometimes some speculation as to why this piece of legislation was passed. But coming through the economic collapse in September of 2008, that was precipitated by a number of bubbles and pressure points within our economy, that led to the advent of Dodd-Frank. I want to spend most of our time talking about where we see the impacts of Dodd-Frank as it relates to state-based regulation, both on the insurance and the security side. And I'd like to keep this as informal and kind of an open dialogue, Mr. Chairman, if we may. I will share with you this, that NAFA members are community-based, independent business owners, and that is who our members are. They serve the middle-income market. We have a lot of empirical data that suggests that our members are clearly Main Street and not Wall Street. Contrary to when I was in visiting with the Securities and Exchange Commission a little over a year ago, where they thought we were merely extensions of Wall Street. We were branch offices of Wall Street. And they could not understand that how we could possibly have one foot in the insurance business and another foot in the investment or securities business. We did an internal study of our members as well as an external study of consumers. The internal study suggested that the NAFA members, 58% of them work with household incomes of less than $100,000. Again, 58%. 77% work with household incomes less than $150,000, and only 11% work with household incomes over $250,000. So clearly, our members are in that middle income market and work with consumers of that type. A couple of interesting surveys that were done. Cirilli and Associates went out to consumers and did a study that was considered statistically valid. that basically indicated that consumers, by a margin of 2-1, would rather pay commissions than they would fees for investment advice and for products. In addition to that, J.D. Power and Company did another survey of consumers, which indicated that consumers really did not have a preference as to whether their advisor was operating under a fiduciary duty standard of care or a suitability standard of care. And what they wanted instead was they wanted their advisor to return their phone calls, hopefully within a reasonable time, such as 24 hours, and they wanted to know how their specific investment portfolio was tracking against common benchmarks. So those were the issues found in the J.D. Power and Associates survey. Again, the Dodd-Frank Wall Street Reform and Consumer Protection Act was enacted July 21st of 2010, a reaction to the financial crisis. The target was really Wall Street, but unfortunately the collateral damage has been on Main Street. Again, the law of unintended consequences is fully at work here. To say this legislation is massive, it is transformational, it is landmark legislation. Really, it is the last of the major pieces of legislation since the Great Depression dealing with financial regulatory reform. There are over 533 mandatory or voluntary rulemaking authorities that have been given to various regulators at the federal level, 67 studies, over 93 periodic reports that are dictated by the Dodd-Frank legislation. Again, a massive document, over 2,700 pages, very comparable to the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act healthcare reform. The issues that are most significant and that we have spent a great deal of time as NAFA leaders is really dealing with the SEC's fiduciary duty standard of care. And for those of you maybe not familiar with that, a fiduciary duty, as many of you know, in a legal sense, is a standard of care that requires a duty of loyalty and a duty of care to the beneficiary or the consumer, in this case. In terms of providing retail investment advice. We have no issue in particular with a fiduciary duty standard of care. As NAFA members, in fact, many of our members, we have about two-thirds of our members that hold at least a Series 6 registered rep registration, and a third of them are actually investment advisor representatives or registered investment advisors. The fiduciary debate continues, and many of you have probably been following this in the media. And our concerns with a one-size-fits-all cookie-cutter approach to the marketplace with a pure fiduciary duty, particularly in the most legal sense, is that it will disenfranchise the middle-income market from access to advice, to financial services, and to financial products. Sure. Dodd-Frank also created a couple of agencies that I think, federal agencies that are new, that I think you are well acquainted with, but I think they deserve some commentary, and certainly we want to try and open up any questions you might have on this. One of them is, of course, the Federal Insurance Office, the FIO. Now, the charges of the FIO are primarily those of dealing with international trade agreements involving insurance. And, of course, the other is on the federal is to modernize state-based regulation. To modernize state-based regulation. And, of course, that is near and dear to all of us. As you know, under McCarran-Ferguson, which is the bedrock of state-based regulation that was passed in 1945, the business of insurance was granted a limited antitrust exemption, even though insurance is interstate commerce, that it could be regulated by the various states. We hold that near and dear and do not want to see that changed. And even though the way the law is written under Dodd-Frank for the FIO, the Federal Insurance Office, that they have no regulatory authority over the business of insurance, our opinion is that we would expect to see mission creep or drift from that, and that in all likelihood there will be more intervention under the guise of modernization, uniformity, reciprocity of state-based regulation of the business of insurance. The other is the Financial Stability Oversight Council, the FSOC, that many of you have heard about. This is dealing with what they call now the SIFIs, the significant financial institutions. In other words, the too big to fail. And we've heard that many times. And in my own opinion, too big to fail was a misnomer. We ought to allow financial institutions to fail. This idea of taxpayer money moving to put a safety net under bad behavior, I think, is unconscionable. We have a process in place already, and it's known as the bankruptcy courts, that they could have gone through to resolve this. But instead, this was a decision that was made to flow money to these firms for bad behavior, where they were leveraging up on certain mortgage-backed securities 30 and 40 times. In other words, for every dollar, 30 to 40 times leverage, and frankly got caught because of these mortgage-backed securities being considered AAA paper by the credit rating agencies. So again, there's a lot of culpability here to go around, and then of course you have AIG with their London office doing the exotic financial products, including credit default swaps, which were again primarily paper. No, didn't want to call them insurance because you'd have to create reserves if it was insurance. There's another entity that was created, and this one we find somewhat disturbing. It's the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. The Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. Primarily, this is a brand new agency. It is funded by the Fed. It has almost unfettered authority. And at the same time, it is accountable to no one. It's not accountable to Congress or to the Fed, but the Fed is funding it. And primarily, these are consumer-oriented financial products that are involved here. Our core products are not included in this, but you have title insurance, you have credit life, accident and health, you have title insurance, those kinds of things. Mortgage products of all types are within this scope of authority of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. And again, they are not accountable to anybody and can at any time call on the Federal Trade Commission to do investigations into any activities that they deem appropriate. The Volcker Rule, many of you have heard of that, but that is also part of Dodd-Frank, where no more than 3% of Tier 1 capital can be invested in hedge funds and private equity funds. And again, you have the, I think the PowerPoint has now been distributed, has it not? So, okay. You can see all of that in terms of the details on the composition of the FIO and also the FSOC and everything. I do want to talk briefly about what has already been passed here through, you know, in the Minnesota legislature. You adopted the National Association of Securities Administrators Association Model Act dealing with senior-specific designations. You did that back in November of 2009, so we commend you for that. In addition, you also enacted the regulation reflecting the NAIC model known as H-1853, and that was done back in 2009 as well. So you have adopted both the Nassau and the NAIC models on senior-specific designations. So we applaud you on that. I know your hearing will continue this afternoon on the NAIC suitability in annuity transactions model. And I know there's you know, some differences on that and everything, but we would urge you to adopt the NAIC model. It is curious that only three of the 38 Model Acts put forward by the NAIC have been adopted uniformly without alteration or modification by the states. But to the extent that happens to us, that somewhat invites the potential intervention of you know, of federal regulation. So, Mr. Chairman, I really think, you know, those were the main highlights that I wanted to cover, and I know you've got a full agenda this afternoon, but I'm certainly open to entertaining any questions. And please keep in mind, there is so much, as there is with healthcare reform, the financial services regulatory reform is still there's so many of the rule makings and everything else that have to take place. But be happy to open it up to questions or comments or reactions. Mr. Chairman, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Headley. We greatly appreciate the presentation. First question or comment, Chairman Davids.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and Mr. Headley, welcome to Minnesota.
Thank you.
And as a disclaimer, I've been a member of your organization since before Mullery was born. So it's been just a couple years. But you know that we have House File 1134 on the agenda today, and this is a very serious bill in my estimation. Under the Harkin Amendment of Dodd-Frank, there are three ways that homegrown or domiciled companies can protect themselves from you know, lawsuits and so forth. One is they can adopt the NAIC model, which generally in Minnesota, I chaired this committee 6 years, and the NAIC would come forth with something and we'd say, okay, yeah, that's good, and it was just kind of a no-brainer, you just did it. You just is what kind of the way we've handled it in the past. Another one of the three forms on the Harkin Amendment said that if you're as stringent as other states around the country, that you have the protection. The other one is if the company, the domiciled company, has a company policy to enact the suitability standards and so forth, that they're okay there. On number two, who would certify that the state of Minnesota had met the criteria for, you know, that you've adopted policies as strong as others?
Mm-hmm. I assume the NAIC would, and would have to certify that. But
well, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Headley, are you aware of any states that have gone through that process, or is it too new?
Mr. Headley?
Yes. Thank you. There are no other states that I'm aware of, and of course 19 states have adopted it without amendment or modification. There are another 7 states pending currently on this model act.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Headley, wouldn't the safest way to go would be to pass House File 1134, have it signed by the governor, as far as, you know, clearing any ancillary issues up?
Yeah, I think if it gets referred out of the committee, it will go to, of course, your House floor, and then hopefully will pass. Likewise, with your counterparts in the Senate, same process and everything, hopefully go to the governor.
Well,
Chairman Davids?
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Headley, if we don't pass it, would you say that our domestic companies are put at a disadvantage as compared to our foreign companies? And when I say foreign, it means not Minnesota. It doesn't mean Jordan, Barbados, or Luxembourg. Would that be a safe statement?
Well, thank you, Representative. You know, that is difficult to predict. I can tell you, interestingly enough, that 40% of all the fixed annuity premium is manufactured in two states, this being one, and your neighbors to the south is the other, in Iowa.
Really?
So 40% of all the fixed annuity premium is manufactured by companies domiciled within Minnesota and Iowa.
Well,
Chairman Davids.
Mr. Chairman and Mr. Headley, I would say that that puts a tremendous amount of importance on House File 1134. If we have 40% of the market in our two states, we certainly don't want to put them at a competitive disadvantage with other companies.
I would agree. I would agree. And keep in mind, not only is this, you know, the suitability in annuities transaction model requires 4 hours up front of annuity training, and then all of the companies, well, not all the companies, but the vast majority of the companies have instituted annuity product-specific training in addition that they require before you can write annuity business.
Well, Mr. Chair, Mr. Headley, I find it kind of interesting that insurance companies are coming to the state and saying, please regulate us. It's kind of an odd situation.
Well, I think this is part of, again, we think this is good for the consumer overall. We know there's been some egregious behavior. We try and, within NAPA, as you know, we have a very stringent code of ethics that we enforce. We want to make sure that NAPA members are, you know, making suitable and proper recommendations to their clients and everything.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Mr. Headley.
Thank you.
Thank you both for that. Next, Representative Mullery.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Davids, thank you for not including Ireland and Scandinavian countries as foreign. And maybe, Representative Davids, you might be an answer to this, but I know I used to pay more attention to NCOIL, and they were proposing annuities regulations. Quite often there's tension between the Commerce Commissioners, the NCIA or whatever it is, and NCOIL. Did NCOIL pursue and finalize, approved anything on this area or on annuities, or are they still just considering something?
Yeah, Mr. Representative, I am not aware of any activity going on within NCOIL. It could be in one of their working groups or committees, but we have not seen any model regulation or act coming from them. Thank you. That's a great question.
Members, any other questions or comments to Mr. Headley? Seeing none, we thank you greatly for your time and your presentation, yeah. Mr. Headley.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Appreciate being here.
At this time, members, we will move to House File 1134. And as Chairman Hoppe is approaching the testifier table, could we have someone approve the minutes from the previous meeting on February 14th? I guess before that, we do have a quorum, so we are in order now. Representative Anderson moves the minutes from February 14th. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Minutes are approved. Chairman Hoppe, welcome and to House File 1134 when you're ready.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I will be brief. I would like to move House File 1134 and move that we send it back to the General Register. We passed this bill, as I'm sure everybody in the committee remembers. We passed this bill, I believe it was unanimously last year, and sent it to the General Register. We did not act on it. We were waiting for the Commerce Commissioner and the Attorney General and the various other parties to do a little bit more fine-tuning on it. We have it back before us. We're going to send it back to the General Register and let them continue that process. And with that, I would stand for questions.
Members, any questions on House File 1134? Seeing none, and since we have had previous testimony on this bill in the past, I guess Chairman Hoppe, if you have any final closing thoughts, but otherwise, if you would just make a motion, renew the motion, and we'll take a vote.
I appreciate everybody's patience and attention, and I would renew my motion that House File 1134 be passed and sent to the General Register.
Chairman Hoppe renews his motion that House File 1134 be recommended to pass and be sent to the General Register. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? House File 1134 is on its way to the General Register. Thank you,
Mr. Chair and members.
Next on the agenda is House File 2174, Representative O'Driscoll.
You see him in the room? Has he been here?
This is becoming a bad sign, right? People have built up here.
Okay, while we're waiting for Representative O'Driscoll to come down, we will move on to House File 2227, Representative Diane Anderson. And then, Representative Anderson, you can make a motion and proceed with your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and the committee. I would like to move House File 2227 to be passed out of the Commerce Committee and be sent to the General Register. Okay. In the past years, the Department of Commerce has routinely had a bill, a banking bill, but it looks like this year they have not decided to bring forward, the Department of Commerce has not decided to bring forth a bill this year. So the Minnesota Bankers Association had a few clarifying and conformity issues that we want to address in this bill that I'm presenting. And so I'd like to, I have an author's amendment. We had some issues that were brought to us by the Department of Commerce, and so basically this amendment, it's the A2 amendment. Mr. Chairman, I'd like to move the A2 amendment.
Thank you, Representative Anderson. The A2 is before us. Members, do you need any explanation, or is it okay to put the bill in the shape that the author wants? All right, with that, all in favor of the A2 amendment, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? The A2 is adopted.
So just to let you know, this amendment has come to us with clarifying language from the Commerce Department, and Tess Rice is here to explain the amendment for me.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Mr. Chair, my name is Tess Rice. I'm with the Minnesota Bankers Association. The bill we have is technical in nature. The first item has to do with when banks can be closed related to a holiday. Banks are not allowed to be closed.
She's just supposed to address the amendment first? Or?
No, feel free.
Okay. Oh, okay. Yeah.
The whole thing.
Sure.
The first part has to do with holidays, allowing banks to be closed on the Saturday following a Friday holiday or the Saturday preceding a Sunday or Monday holiday. The statute is unclear as it's written right now, and this would clarify that. The other two changes have to do with conformance with Dodd-Frank. The Dodd-Frank Act repealed a federal law that prohibited banks from paying interest on demand deposits. We have a law in Minnesota that was modeled on the federal law, and this would repeal the state language. The other issue has to do with regulating derivatives. Dodd-Frank changed the National Bank's lending limit statute to regulate derivatives, and we would change the state lending limit statute with very similar language.
For Representative Lilly's sake, could you explain derivatives in 30 words or less?
Are you serious, Mr. Chair?
Always. No. Thank you. Yeah, Representative Lilly is. thank you for your testimony, Ms. Rice. Members, do you have any questions for the testifier, for the author? Is there anyone else in the audience that wishes to testify for or against the bill? Seeing none, Representative Anderson, if you would, any final comments, and then please renew your motion.
Well, thank you, members of the committee. I think this bill is something that is in agreement, has not any opposition to this bill. So I just would appreciate your support, and I'd like to renew my motion to have the House File 2227 be passed and referred to the House floor.
Representative Anderson renews her motion that House File 2227 as amended be passed and sent to the General Register. All in favor, please say aye.
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 Opposed?
No.
Bill is passed as amended. Thank you. And I believe I saw Representative O'Driscoll back in the room. There you are. We will move on to House File 2174. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I apologize for not being here when you were looking for me before, but I was unavoidably detained on this. House File 2174 is a bill that we're putting forward that will allow public institutions like cities to be able to deposit money into a program that will be FDIC insured. If you recall last year, we did a similar type of correction to allow in state statute the FDIC insurance to be counted towards security of collateralization for financial within a financial institution here in the state of Minnesota. What this does is this allows certificates of deposit are currently allowed under state law to be FDIC insured and to be in multiple financial institutions. We have a program that's available to banks here in the state of Minnesota that would allow, in essence, a money market or similar to a money market type transaction that would allow for FDIC deposit insurance to be put forward on large deposits within financial institutions that might otherwise aggregate against the $250,000 limit. One thing that's important as we start this conversation is that no public money is used to pay for the insurance on this because it is FDIC insurance. The financial institution pays the insurance to the FDIC to get this type of coverage. Today I have with me Steve Davis, and he is going to be discussing with us how the program works. And Mr. Chair, I'd like to turn it over with your blessings to Mr. Davis.
Welcome, Mr. Davis, to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Representatives. I'm Steve Davis. I work for Promontory Interfinancial Network, although they're headquartered out of Washington. I live in Des Moines, Iowa. The program is really just an adjustment what has been used by Minnesota banks for a number of years. About $1.7 billion have been used in the CDARS programs to protect public funds and keep the money in the state for loans and economic development. In working with our Minnesota banks, they have been asked by the public entities, could they have a money market, not a term deposit, to help manage their liquidity? And that's what this is. The ICS money market is a liquid version of the CDARS program, same mechanism. It allows a public entity to have up to $50 million of full FDIC insurance per deposit, and it keeps money within the state of Minnesota under the one-for-one-dollar exchange. So just a technical adjustment to what banks have been using to meet the needs of public entities in Minnesota for the last number of years.
Thank you, Mr. Davis. Representative O'Driscoll, I've noticed here we have the DE-1 in the packet. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, thank you. What we're going to do is I think we'll move with the bill as it currently stands, and okay. This is going to be, once we're done with this, if it passes, I'd like to have it go to the Government Operations and Elections Committee, and we'll take amendments at that committee today instead of here today.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, if I might add one other item, if I might add on this, and that is will allow the money to stay within the communities and within the state of Minnesota so that our financial institutions would be able to use this to make loans where otherwise it may go out of the state if we don't allow a program similar to this.
Thank you. Chairman Davis.
Mr. Chairman, from the author, can we just have a brief sketch of what the amendment does? I think the Commerce Committee should kind of know about it. I want to make sure it doesn't do anything to convention centers in Minneapolis or anything.
Representative O'Driscoll.
All right. Two things. We had a host of amendments that we were considering before committee today, and the one that I was thinking of was going to be dealing with credit unions, but I was asking to defer that to the Government Operation and Elections Committee.
Okay.
And because they are also an organization that can take the public deposits here in the state of Minnesota, we wanted to deal with that, but again, it's coming down the pike pretty quickly today. We want to make sure that we don't have any issues with that. And if the committee's okay with the credit unions, if it works out for them being a part of that, we would take care of that amendment in the Commerce Committee. But the DE-1 amendment would be acceptable today as an amendment.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Representative O'Driscoll, if that's the direction you want to move, we'd be happy to do that. Just go ahead and offer up the amendment.
I move the DE-1 amendment. And that... If it's the committee's wishes, that it then be approved and we move forward upon final vote at the committee to the Government Operations and Elections Committee.
Mr. Chair, if I might.
Representative Atkins.
Just for the comfort of the members, if you can, once you've got the, I don't really see it as a big deal if, your representation has been that it's going to be a non-controversial kind of add-on later. But if you'd be so kind, perhaps, is to send it back around just to this group. and certainly the I assume the chair and the committee administrator are monitoring it anyway, but if it does become some kind of death spiral or something, it'd be good to know that back here before it moves on. If it's completely non-controversial, just let us know that. We'll see you on the floor.
Thank you, Representative Atkins. Representative O'Driscoll.
Mr. Chair, Representative Atkins, you can count on it.
Thank you.
Good deal. Representative Mullery.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And first of all, I want to thank Representative Davids for voicing his disapproval of anybody that is thinking of messing around with the Minneapolis Convention Center and its tax. I'm glad to hear that change from Monday. I'm trying to find it in here. Does the FDIC then insure these up to $50 million for money markets? And does this then limit it to that amount that can go in?
Representative O'Driscoll or Mr. Davis?
What I think I'm going to do in the interest of clarity on this, I'm going to turn it over to Mr. Davis since he does work on that on a regular basis.
What we do is we're working through what is called the FDIC pass-through insurance rule, which was set up years ago where banks could share FDIC insurance. So that's the rule that we've worked through. Right now, the guideline is $50 million per customer. It could go higher than that based on, you know, what happens in the future. But right now, any entity could have $50 million in this money market, and then they could also have $50 million in the CD program. So the total coverage that's available for full FDIC insurance is $100 million. Public entity.
Mr. Chairman, just one.
Representative Mullery.
The one question you didn't answer is, okay, someplace in this bill does it limit how much they put into what's under the limit? I haven't found that yet, but maybe it's in there.
Mr. Davis.
Does this bill limit it to the $50 million?
No. The bill does not directly spell that out, but that's the federal guideline, so that would supersede state law because it's a federal program.
I guess I thought,
Representative
Mullery, Mr. Chairman, I guess I thought we were authorizing okay, I'll have to figure this out before next committee.
Representative
O'Driscoll.
To Representative Mullery's question, I don't think we want to restate in state statute what the federal regulation is, since it's going to mimic that. So if that were to change at some point in the future, we'd have to come back and amend state statute on that as well. And maybe I'm not getting the question from Representative Mullery, but that would be our reason and our rationale on that.
Mr. Pender has some light that he can shed on that, so we'll turn it over to him.
Mr. Chair and Representative Mullery, in each section of this bill, it says that the full amount, for instance, on page one of the bill at the bottom, the full amount of the redeposited district funds plus accrued interest, if any, must be insured by the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation. So, in other words, in order for the deposit to be made, there has to be the FDIC coverage for it. And that sentence is included in each section of this bill.
Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Pender. Representative Mullery.
Thank you. And Mr. Pender, that's exactly what I was looking for, so thank you.
Thank you much. Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative O'Driscoll and Representative Davids. I'm glad we're taking care of this here where we have Mr. Pender available, as opposed to GovOps, that where we may not have this in our expertise.
Right.
So,
right.
And as to Representative Davids, I've already got that amendment made up for the convention center.
Seeing no further questions on the DE1, we will move to a vote on the DE1. All in favor of that amendment, please say aye.
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 Opposed? The amendment is adopted. Representative O'Driscoll, two-year bill as amended.
Again, I renew my motion to move this bill, if it passes today, to government operations and elections. And again, keeping Representative Atkins' wishes to let this committee know if that amendment is successful or if there's a reason to re-refer, we'll do that as well.
Thank you for that commitment, Representative O'Driscoll. With that, he renews his motion that House File 2174 is amended, be passed, and recommended to be sent to the Committee on Government Operations. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The bill as amended is adopted.
Thank you.
With that, Chairman Hoppe.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair and members. We are
Tuesday?
Tuesday we are going to have Telecom Day, and I believe what we're going to do is use the what was known as the AT&T bill last year. We're going to use that. We're going to take out the parts that the federal government has made sort of obsolete, and my intention is to have a not really a milquetoast, but a pretty non-controversial telecom reform bill, since a lot of these statutes have not been reformed. Well, some of them have never been reformed, and most of them have not been looked at since the 80s, since Ma Bell was around. When the statutes were written, nobody was thinking of satellite or wireless or anything like that, and I think it's long past time that we take a look at that section of statute and try to clean it up and make it more of a level playing field and make it better for all the companies concerned. So we're going to have a presentation on what the FCC did in their last actions last August or September, and then we're going to have discussion on the bill with the idea that we will lay it over, let the various parties involved get together and come up with what they think needs to be in there and shouldn't be in there for a week or so, and then we'll bring it back, maybe 2 weeks, and then we'll bring it back and try to pass something that would be good, boring, bipartisan telecom regulation. And that's all I know. Thank you.
With that, members, we are adjourned. Thank you.